Personally, this last week was a difficult week for me. There was all the passings that happened of Yael and Daniel, and then 2 days ago, the sister of Rachel passed away. She said she was. We were actually sitting here, Motzei Shabbat, together. It was my birthday. There was a small gathering, and in the middle of that, Rachel's sister rang and said she's taken lots of pills. She doesn't want to live anymore. And this happened 10 hours before that, so we weren't that worried. And she was talking, and she was so Rachel said, "Well, I'll get an ambulance for you anyway." So she got an ambulance, and she walked to the ambulance. She was all right, even though she took the pills 10 hours before. But then in hospital, she gradually died. And this, and I was sick at the same time. And all of these things together created an energy of vulnerability. And the energy of vulnerability goes in two directions. We can take it personally, and then we're holding something very painful, difficult, and at the same time, the potential in it for freeing ourselves. Because if we face real difficulty, we're right there in the eye of the storm, we're right there in the middle of life. So, personally, it's a pain is a personal dialogue, and it's a universal thing. So at the same time, there was the universal of difficult time and people passing, and it's not in our hands, and it's something much bigger, and the cycle of life, and so on. And I think one of the issues with compassion is really holding the personal and the impersonal, and the play between personal and impersonal. And to me, this was this last week, it was something that I was very engaged with, is like working through the personal and the impersonal, the big vision. And I think the two needn't be very separate. But the movement from the personal to breaking boundaries through understanding of human suffering to beyond the boundaries is the movement of compassion. The compassion grows as much as we can dissolve the boundaries that we have to it. And in a bigger sense, compassion is basically an understanding of sharing samsara together. We were not asked to be born. We were dumped into a body. We were dumped into this existence. And embodiment is not easy. And all conventional experience that we experience as a body has in it dukkha. All. Even a little bit. The fact that we are in form already limits us. We are form, we are body that changes, you know, the whole thing. A thought is already has in it dukkha, just because it's a form and not something infinite. So everything formed has in it dukkha, that's samsara. And that understanding is the big view that leads to compassion, that we share together our partnership in samsara, therefore we share together common dukkha. And when we feel that, our heart is open to it. We can see it stand in front of a tree and say, "I know you. You are struggling like me. I can see it in the way you're trying to do this, and a branch is like this, and a leaf is like that, and the roots are trying to get more water, and you can see it in everything is struggling in samsara." So that sharing is compassion. And that compassion is a very pure place. So it's moving from the self to the non-self, in a way, is the whole process of development of compassion. And understanding that once we're in a body, there is going to be so much devotion to survival of all beings, and we share that, and we know that, and that's compassion. It rests on empathy, and empathy is the sense that we're not locked in a shell, in a box. And we can see it because everyone wants to help everyone else, actually. I watch this with my grandchildren. You think, oh, children, you know, they hit each other all the time. They're always taking toys. Mine, give me. This is mine. This is mine. You took from me. But if you watch children, they have a huge amount of empathy as well. One minute they're fighting each other, the next minute if something happens, they're protecting each other. Sisters hit each other, and the next second they're absolutely loving and protective of each other and will really do everything they can to help each other. So, every human being would help someone else, a blind person, cross the road. Every human being pretty well would help a blind person cross the road, meaning they have it in them, a sense of care for others. But the only trouble is it's limited. So they'll help a blind man cross the road, but maybe not do it three times. Or they'll help a blind man cross the road, but they wouldn't help someone they don't know, or who isn't obviously blind, or is not close to them, or doesn't, or whatever, or they're afraid. So very quickly, you reach the boundary. So it's not that this thing isn't there. It's there in us. It's there in animals. It's there in children. It's there. But the question is the boundary. And how much boundary there is and how soon we reach it. And that's where the movement to compassion is all the time moving the boundary out. So in a sense, every bit of Dharma practice that we do that leads to less selfing will automatically create more compassion, because it simply moves that boundary out. And someone who is really practiced in non-self will be compassionate and will really not need to practice anything to develop compassion. It happened by itself. Like metta and compassion are very close, the Brahma Viharas are very close. They happen by themselves, because you can't not respond with your heart to others, if you're not busy with self, if you're not locked in self, it will just, someone else's joy will touch you and you'll be joyful. Someone else's pain will touch you and you'll cry. And I just noticed in my own experience, the more I practice over the years, the more easy it is for me to cry when someone else near me is crying. It can be anybody, about anything. I can suddenly find myself crying just because someone next to me is crying. It happens in one-to-ones with 5 minutes in retreats. Suddenly someone's crying and I'm also crying. And I don't know why. And I know it's just being with them, and the same with laughter, and the same with everything else. So the bodhisattva is the image in the Tibetan tradition, but not only Tibetan, is also the Theravada tradition also knows the bodhisattva. but it's not developed as much in Theravada tradition. And the Bodhisattva is really characterized by that movement when there is no self, that responds to life, that is with life, the life manifesting of non-self is compassion, is the Bodhisattva. That, in other words, not a neutral kind of machine called non-self, which is like the cosmos. It doesn't have anything. It's the person developed, the heart, the person developed beyond the boundaries of the person in the vibrations of life, in being alive, in being, and then everything that's done is in the form of compassion. That means for life, for others, for ba'ad, just simply for, not against, just simply for. And it goes in a very deep place in the Bodhisattva tradition, but also, you know, in a way, in the Dharma itself, because the world is not a thing out there, but the world is created partly by your own mind. You are forming the world as you're aware of it. The world is not just a thing out there. The world is created by the way you see it and the way you are with it. And so, from the place of the Bodhisattva, from the place of heart connection to all life, then as you create the world by seeing, knowing, awareness, you're creating a better world. So compassion is an active thing. Compassion, when you create the world by seeing, you're creating a better world through compassion. That's the Bodhisattva, and that's actually what we are doing. By connecting with our minds with reality every moment, we're in a way, compassion is happening. We're creating in some way a better world, not a worse world. In the Kabbalah, it's really interesting that the early word for compassion is rachamim, and rachamim is from rechem, the womb, and rechem is active, but female. Active in the sense that the womb gives nutrition, protection, and enclosure, and holding. That's the function of womb. And bringing life. And it's the female qualities, exactly those, if you like, yin, holding, supporting, feeding, protecting. Exactly those are female qualities, but active female qualities. And so it's, in a sense, in the Kabbalah, it's the male form of the feminine. And that's why in the Kabbalah, rachamim is on the male side, not on the female side. It's on the right-hand side of the sefirot. And because it's the male, it's the active form of female energy. And it's opposed to din. And din is just the dryness. I was talking about it with Rachel this morning, and she said, yeah, that God tried to make the world, first of all, based on din. Could be the laws of nature, for example. You could regard din as a chokei teva, or like a computer runs. Things in place, everything in place. And it couldn't, God failed. It just didn't work. He couldn't make the world from, that's a Kabbalistic story. I don't know where it comes from, but God tried to made the world actually based on din, and it didn't work. So he had to bring the female, namely Rachamim. But it's still a male, it has a male in it. You say, El Male Rachamim. It has a male, in the Jewish world, it has a male quality to it because it's active. Still the womb, but there's an action there. And compassion is just like that. It's active. It's not passive. Compassion is active. It is exactly as we create the world by seeing, we create, we are acting, we are interacting. That movement is the movement of compassion. And in the end, every single act, thought, word that we do, in the end, in a place of non-self, turns into compassion. Every single one. Because there isn't a choice here. The fact of interacting with life is compassion. So, however, on the level of self, so I'm coming back to self and non-self all the time, but on the level of self, sure, compassion needs development. And sure, we can develop it. And we do need to practice it. And it is helpful to us to practice compassion. But remember that we're talking here about, in a way, practice of any practice of non-self leads to compassion, but any practice of compassion leads to non-self. Because they're going in the same direction. They're both about moving the boundary from self-interest to sharing samsara with all beings, or being with and knowing the tree, I know your struggle. It's always in the same direction. So actually it doesn't matter so much. You can decide to practice compassion. You have non-self movement, less boundary, or practice no boundaries, you'll find compassion. So it's a shift in the mind and the heart. It goes in both places. And I think one of the, I would like to talk about several, three or four ways where we practice compassion. And I'm going to talk about it, first of all, in terms of remembering our natural goodness, remembering something basic, like the child in us that wants to help our sister or brother, or our parents, or ourselves. I'm going to talk about it in, as I say, reducing blocks, which are to do with boundary and protection. And the third way I'm going to talk about it is really just a sense of opening the heart and remembering our vulnerability. And so these are basically the three directions for developing compassion. So the first is remembering our natural goodness. And it really is about something very fundamental, like the mother in us that knows what it's like to have a crying baby, that we don't throw the baby away when the baby cries. We hold the baby when the baby cries. And it's something very fundamental in us too. If we are hurt, the first thing we do is hold it. The first thing we do is touch ourselves. If we ourselves are hurt, we try and hold someone else if they are hurt. We hug somebody else. We embrace. The first thing that happened, I just was noticing it at the Yael's funeral, how just in an intuitive, basic, fundamental human way, everybody was hugging everybody at the funeral. And I was just noticing how it came from such a kind of obvious place. And And this is the place. The natural goodness in us, it's a sense of remembering it and giving it space and giving it attention. And seeing it. And it's based, this goodness, on something very fundamental, which is that we are like others, that we are the same as others. So we hug each other because we are actually, it's like hugging ourselves. Affinity, you call it in English. We are close, we are belonging to each other in some way. So it's actually, and then we forget it. So we're not hugging each other. And then we remember and then we hug ourselves. It's a sense of natural affinity. It just needs to be remembered, to be focused on. It comes in so many different shapes and sizes. It can be a sense of sangha. It can be a sense of being close to ourselves. It can be a sense of wanting to the best for ourselves and others. It can be a sense of blessing and blessings that we give to each other and to ourselves. It's so many different ways. But if we just focus on those things that are happening to us, can be a sense of, oh well, that's the way things are. A kind of a, you know, okay, I'm with it. I'm in my mitzvot, in my reality, it's okay. Even that, just something to being together with things. And if we keep focusing on that, it helps to develop compassion. Just to notice it, to notice that it's happening all the time. To notice that it's happening all the time in our experience. And this develops compassion very powerfully. We see it, it's happening in us. Rather than the compassion as being something we have to find kind of over there and somehow collect it, read lots of texts and have lots of teachings about it and hear Dharma talks about it and, you know, collect it from somewhere else. It's much more a sense there of noticing it as natural goodness in our very actions, in our very existence, in the way we're looking after ourselves, in the way we automatically help a blind person cross the road, the way we look after someone if they're sick, we look after ourselves if we're sick. It's just very, very fundamental. And just being with that fundamental energy. And part of that is also remembering the pain of embodiment. Like I said at the beginning, it needs to be known, it needs to be remembered, that pain is not personal. It's in the samsara. So we are embodied and we hurt. And other beings are embodied and they hurt. And it's just knowing that we're all taking part in the struggle and the struggle for life. Like I said, the tree is doing it. We're doing it. Each one of us is doing it in our own way. We are struggling. And that kind of also reduces the tendency to criticize and attend, judge ourselves or others, and allows a much bigger view. Yes, we're dropped into this body. Here I am in this crazy life, samsara. I make the best of it, and everyone else is too. And so someone being angry with me, I can see, okay, yes, I see your pain. That's a movement of compassion. Someone else who's violent, I see your pain too. It reduces the sense of friction and separation means it helps us to practice compassion as sympathy based on empathy, natural goodness, sympathy, seeing that we're sharing this samsara together. So I want to talk a few minutes about the blocks and the blockages, which are all about self and boundary. And I did, when I kind of thought about it, I remembered, actually, I found a talk I gave on compassion some time ago, and in that talk I gave a little story, and it's a fresh, very fresh memory for me. And one day, I was looking after two grandchildren, and one of them was kind of demanding, and I was tired. And she kept asking for this and asking for that, and then this one, and then she wanted this instead of that. And then it was, you know, he was like that, he was demanding, and I was getting tired, and I just felt I really didn't want this anymore, I couldn't cope with this anymore. And then bedtime came, oh, thank goodness, they're ready for bed. I'm ready to put them to bed and shut them up. And as a last straw, this grandchild said, I said, go and do pee-pee. This is time before bed. Go do pee-pee. She said, no, I need you to come with me. What? I was really tired. And also that you want, you can't even do that on your own. And I said, I was, you know, angry a bit. And you need me for that as well. And she said, but I'm afraid of the dark there. And all of a sudden, my whole reactivity collapsed, you know, and just out came compassion and energy, of course. I was totally able to help them, and the energy arose from compassion. I saw it a totally different way, that it wasn't her. It was her struggle for life, for samsara, for her fears were arriving in through embodiment. It was nothing that, you know, it was like I realized that I was in a person place. I'm tired, I can't deal with this, and so on and so on. And suddenly, when she said that, I found the non-person place of, yes, I know you, I understand you now, your fear of the dark that's growing in you, I feel it, I see it, I know it. It's come, I see how it's come. And I'm with you, and yeah, of course I'll take you to the toilet. And and I just tell this story because in me it's a personal experience of this shift, which was really, really strong. In one instant, the whole thing shifted, and my tiredness disappeared completely. And it was amazing, you know, to reflect on that. And so I think that these are the sort of blocks where you feel the self. The self gives you blocks to compassion. And the minute you notice that you are blocked, then in a way something is lifted. You can't give to 100 Indian beggars. You can give to 10, and then you've had enough. That's your limit. Compassion doesn't say that you have to keep giving to the other 100. It doesn't say what you need to do. Compassion doesn't mean to say that you do this. But it means that when we're talking about blocks, it's important to feel your limit at the 10th Indian beggar and say, this is where I am. This is my limit. This is where I can be. I can't be there. I'm not able to give to 500 Indian beggars for reasons, personal reasons, or I don't have the money, or I don't know, 100 other reasons. It's not up to us. We're all samsara. They're in samsara, and you're also in samsara. They're a beggar, and you're not a beggar. So what? You can be other way around. Tomorrow you could die, and they could be happy. You don't know. And but it's kind of making that limit alive to you. and working with that limit of finding a limit to self where your compassion has a boundary. Because if you know the boundary, then it moves. It's being aware of that boundary, and then it moves. And the boundary can, I just can't do this anymore. You and your, you know, so a daily life working in the social change field, and is going to be meeting this every single day. And it's not up to us to set rulers measuring, I ought to be more compassionate. But it is up to us to say, okay, here's my limit, I'm with that. In fact, sort of being compassionate to ourselves is also knowing where our limits are, and it's always limits of self. It's not limits of money, you know, you can't save the world, but it's limits of self, where my self is. So you can only give to 10 beggars, but how do you give to those 10 beggars, and how do you not give to the 90 others? How are you with that is the key, rather than I have to give to 100 beggars. So just staying on that boundary, I'm noticing, and very often in noticing our preferences, that means noticing our protection, noticing where we are protecting ourselves. Like I say many times, but you know, aniyim ircha kodmim. Where is ircha? Is it my neighbors? Is it my people? Is it the whole world? Is it the people with the same color of skin as me? Or not, or whatever. In this area of selfing, there's also a lot of muddle and mixture between compassion and pity. Pity in the English, I mean, which would be, you know, chemla v'rachamim. You know, kind of, there's a lot of issues around there where I am with compassion or pity. It's about noticing it. There's issues around needing to help others. Again, a kind of a selfing. I have to help others. It's a compulsion. It's not a freedom. So you might find yourself easily trapped in that. There's something very, very much I noticed in the English, in the language in England. And England has had a terrible past. And has fought more wars than almost any other country in the world. And yet English people now are tremendously nice to each other. And it's all in the language. They're all the time polite, all the time kind, all the time smiling, all the time nice. And you can think, well, these people have been fighting everybody in the whole planet, have been taking over the whole planet, have been stealing everything they could put their hands on in the whole planet. And now they're nice and nice and nice and smiling. Never mind the history. But there is something there which is like not true, which is your smile or your niceness or whatever. And we're all affected by that. We all want to be nice. It is based on natural, what I said before, natural goodness. It's true. It's all right to be nice. It's not a problem to be nice. It's based on natural goodness, but we should notice when it's mixed with self, with some compulsion. I have to be nice. It's social to be nice. I need to smile all the time. I need to say nice things to myself or others. Or I need to help others. Why am I needing to help others? Really, because I need to help myself. Because I had a hard time when I was a kid, and the only way I can work that one out is to try and help repair everybody. Classic psychologists' trap, or doctors. So 90% of the doctors and psychologists in the world have that one. And that makes them exhausted after a while, because they see life isn't like that really, because they come with their own story of having to repair the world in some way because of their own stuff. And so the compulsion, is in the automatic goodness, attempt for the automatic goodness, is an exhausting issue based on self. So it's another example of blocks to compassion. based on selfing, based on me, my story, my need for niceness, my need for things to be better. I know it's paradoxical. I know that you might, you know, most people kind of can't really understand this. But compassion doesn't have in it a need for things to be better. Okay. Real compassion doesn't have a need for things to be better. It has a sense that things are what they are because they are like that. They're already good enough. We don't need to repair the world. But compassion is just this flow of being together with, being the womb. But not from a need place, I must get the world better. It's a problem, the world, I have to fix it. That's again the self coming up. And one final point I think about self, I mean there's many examples, and I think we're going to discuss this together in small groups, we're going to work on these things, because we each have our own stories of the way the self limits compassion. But another way that we go about this, another game we play is often what the Tibetan teacher called, I like this one, is called idiot compassion. You probably know about this. It's where you give things to people which they really shouldn't have, but because of the niceness, because you're trying to be good, nice to them, you like giving cigarettes to encourage someone to smoke because they need a cigarette, so you give them a cigarette. It may be okay to give them a cigarette, but you also need to be free enough to say, this is not the right time to give an addict drugs. You might just say, yes, I will give the addict drug. But you might say no. Or I think a lot of medicine today is based on idiot compassion, which is to give drugs to shut up people. To give drugs in order to shut up pain, to give drugs Valium in order to shut up anxiety, to give drugs in order to stop complaining, to give drugs in order to stop people having to relate to people. You just give drugs in order, especially in the mental health field, give drugs in order to shut people up, keep them functioning more or less, and shut them up. So, and the final sort of place of development of compassion is really the more classic work of opening the heart to just opening the heart to allowing yourself to feel and to respond to pain and suffering and dukkha of yours and others. And sometimes you really need to do it. Sometimes you just need to do it. In other words, it may be the only thing that will help you. Whereas you're having sort of real difficulty, dukkha somewhere, and you can't do you can't do vipassana with it. You've got a pain. I mean, the one I don't like is the dentist. And it really is hard for me to work with it. And I try in doing it through mindfulness, but sometimes it's not enough. And I find that compassion nearly always works because it shifts the view. So where vipassana doesn't, maybe not strong enough, mindfulness maybe not strong enough to actually deal with or change something in you, a relationship to something that is painful, compassion can come in there as a place that shifts your relationship to pain, and therefore it's a really, there's a place where you practice compassion, where practice is really needed. I have a quote from the Buddha that says, life in any world is unstable, it's swept away. Life in any world, including the gods, world of the gods, every world, every realm, life in any world has no protector, has no shelter, has nothing of its own, it has to be left, is incomplete, is unsatisfying, it leads to craving. It's heavy, but it's true. So when you understand that, the heart is opened by a sense of sharing that samsara with others. So it is practice that is in a way needed to keep opening that heart energy. And they do it in the Theravada, but the monks at the time of the Buddha, you probably know this, they used to practice it with vibration. After a certain amount of initial practice, the monks practice on ethics and practice on the Eightfold Path, and then some right view, sort of beginning of, should we say, awareness practice. It says that this is how a monk practices compassion. He dwells, stays, in other words, over a period of time, pervading, spreading one quarter, meaning physically one quarter of the 360 degrees, so one quarter, with a mind full of compassion. And then the second quarter, and then the third quarter, and then the fourth quarter, and then above, below, across, and everywhere, to everyone and all beings, and to himself, he dwells, spreading the entire world with a mind full of compassion, vast, exalted, meaning above, or what's the word in Hebrew? Exalted would be measureless, that has no measure, without any ill will or hostility, and just like a strong blower of a trumpet, a conch shell, can easily send his signal to all the quarters of the world. So, too, when liberation of mind by compassion is developed and cultivated in this way, any limited karma that was done does not remain there, does not persist there. So that's I think I'll leave it at that. And with just one final sentence, that a lot of what I've been saying has in it wisdom and compassion in balance. I haven't called it wisdom, but right at the beginning when I was talking about the way that the limit to compassion are around self, so that would mean we need that wisdom. And that's why the Eightfold Path is a preparation in the Theravada texts for the monks to practice compassion. They needed the Eightfold Path first to have some degree of awareness, some degree of wisdom. Right, it says right view. Right view means non-self. So there's some degree of non-self is needed before you can practice this big heart, open heart. Because otherwise the self comes in, like I said before, and will always create boundaries. So let's just take a moment. to reflect, just take 1-2 minutes.